Wow. And I say wow again because you have such an opportunity being here this week. I didn't have this opportunity as a young teacher when I started in 1967. We did start the Christian Teachers Institute that we went to each fall. And I still remember those were the days when you really got lots of help and encouragement. A weekend, Friday, Saturday, and those were so encouraging, those times. But this is far better. And so I'm glad to see that you're taking the opportunity to do this. You must be getting lots of help. Now, I would be interested in knowing who I'm speaking to. How many of you will be entering your first year this year, this coming year? Okay, a couple of hands. How many of you will be are less than 5 years in teaching experience? Okay, most of the hands. How about more than 10 years? Okay, all right, very good. So we have a variety of teaching experience here. I have no idea if we'll get through this little list or not. It's not a very fancy list. You know, I've been out of the classroom for 11 years now, and things are starting to get a little foggy. And as I began to contemplate after I was asked to give this presentation, if I had to do it over, I had to do some thinking. But I assure you that the things that I have on this list are the very things that must have made an impression on me, because those are the things that came to my mind. And I hope they will be of value to you. Probably my teaching experience was different. What yours is, and perhaps though you can suit it to fit your particular situation, and maybe it'll be useful to you. I'd like to give you a little bit of a background of my own teaching experience. I taught for 31 years. My first 8 years were with a church school, my own church school in Hartford, Ohio. And except for one of those 8 years, I taught in another state. I won't tell you where that was. Then, the following 23 years, I taught in Holmes County in a public school with all Amish children. And that is a story in itself. It's very unique. It's probably one of the most unique schools anywhere in the country. Public, but all Amish students. And so, in a way, it was kind of like a Christian school. We were given a lot of freedom to do, teach, you know, how we wanted. So that's my background. And I suppose most of the, many of the illustrations that I have here come from the last 23 years where I taught in the public Amish school setting. The most valuable lesson I learned was one that Maynard taught me. It was my third year of teaching, and it was the year that my wife and I moved to another state. It was a high school, the junior high and high school combined had about 120 students. I didn't know a single one. You ever get yourself in a situation like that? I didn't know anybody. We had a teaching staff of about 10 to 12. I only knew one. So I was thrust in a situation of not knowing anybody, terribly green. Even in 3 years, I was still very inexperienced. I don't know how you feel as a beginning teacher, but don't let that frighten you, because that's just the way that I think we all kind of feel. I was teaching a 12th grade class of government, 21 students. These are seniors, high school seniors. There's some bright students in that class. They're probably smarter than me in many ways. In that class was Maynard. Maynard wasn't getting it. First, I didn't know anybody. I didn't know the families. I didn't know the students. Maynard was not cutting it. He wasn't passing. And he didn't, what bothered me the most was that he didn't seem very concerned about it. And occasionally, he was nice. He would come in and into class and he was friendly. But, and occasionally I would catch him shooting a paper wad across the room. And I was really, about 6 weeks into school, I was really becoming quite frustrated with Maynard. I had just about had it with him. But fortunately, I hadn't done anything yet. Parent-teacher conferences came along one of the first Saturdays, Fridays and Saturdays in November. We had had school for about 6 weeks. His mother came in. She told me that just a year earlier, Maynard's brother, just 1 year younger, was killed in a farm accident. She said Maynard wasn't the same. It really bothered him. He said the two boys were like that. Furthermore, she would catch him sometimes evenings at home, sitting in the chair, just staring. And it really bothered her as to what was going on in Maynard's mind. I didn't know that. I want you to know something. When Maynard walked into class on Monday morning, I saw a different Maynard. Now, I can't tell you that his grades shot up, because it didn't. But I looked at a hurting Maynard, a young man who was struggling with what had just happened in his life. And I tried to, as I dealt with him, as I worked with him, I saw a different person. And you'll never know when a youngster walks in. Now, I know that a lot of you teach in your church school, and you probably know the children, your students, really, really well. You know everything about them. I don't know what your background, what your situation is. But even then, if you teach in a church school, you don't know when a child walks into class in the morning, maybe their pet was killed the night before, got run over on the road. Maybe an argument with a sibling that morning before they got to school. All kinds of things could have happened. And you don't know what's going on in that little head when they walk into class. Just be sensitive to what's going on. We don't, as teachers, we don't know everything that has happened or is happening in that child. That lesson from Maynard went with me. That happened the third year of my teaching experience. I never forgot. And I tried to remember that something may be going on in a child's head that I'm not aware of, and try to be sensitive to it. First day activities. The first day is always important. One of the things I used to do is, at the end of the first day, by the way, I taught mostly, I was going to mention this in my background is mainly junior high. I taught probably 7th, 8th graders most of the years that I taught. Maybe 4 or 5, I taught some high school classes. So those of you who are junior high school teachers, this is a tough age. And it's a very challenging age. But one of the things I would do, and I want you to, if you can learn anything from any of these things, model it to your own use, and hopefully it will be beneficial to you. I would frequently, at the end of the first day, I would have them write a short essay, give them maybe 10 minutes, and maybe title it Reflections of My First Day at School. And you'd be surprised what the things they came up with. You see, they were still a blank sheet of paper. There were no teacher-student issues yet. And they could sort of freely write about how they felt. And there's some really interesting things that come up on that after that first day. Impressions they had that you didn't think they'd have. And then I would collect those. And I would keep them until the last day of school. And then I'd return them. So a couple times I'd forget. And many of those classes had class reunions, and I try to go to class reunions. I think you should too. If your students have a class reunion and they invite you, you should have the courtesy to attend it if you possibly can. So on several occasions I would return them on those days. You ought to see the eyes wide open when some of these were parents, and here they get this little essay they wrote in seventh or eighth grade of reflections of my first day at school, and they would read them, and of course they kind of remember that they, some of the things they came up with. Picture bulletin board. I got this idea from another teacher. By the way, most of us hardly ever come up with things ourselves, do we? So we learn from others, and that's one of the benefits of a teacher a week like this, is you learn things and find things out from other teachers. And I can't say that I came up with this idea myself, but it was such a good idea that I did it for the last, only about the last 10 years of my teaching. On the first day of school, I take my camera to school. Now, of course, I was teaching Amish children, and the picture taking is generally not accepted, but I had gotten the approval of the parents by this point, and they knew, of course, that I was going to publish these pictures in the newspaper or anything like that. But what I did is I took my camera to school, and I laid aside maybe a half hour, and I would take each child one at a time in the same spot, and I'd do a pretty close up, maybe from here on out. It was a fairly blown up picture of the person's face. Do each student, and same background, and then I would develop those pictures overnight. Took them in the Walmart or wherever, developed them overnight. Took them back the next day. This is like the second day of school, right? Second day of school, and I'd give them a piece of. I'm getting so long out of the classroom. You call that. Paper, construction paper. See, I give them a piece of construction paper. I let them pick their own color, and so you had orange, yellow, and green, And then they were to paste their picture. They were so excited to get their picture. This is exciting, especially a close-up picture. And they'd attach the picture to this piece of construction paper. And then they were to take a color, a marker that was in contrast to the construction paper, and they would write their name vertically, and then for each letter of their name, they would write a short phrase describing themselves as a person, maybe their likes or dislikes. And I'm not done yet, and so they would write short phrases that describe them as a person. Using their first name, only their first name. There would be a room for their last name too. They would make these and then hand them back in. Then the next morning when they came to school, third day of school, they were on the bulletin board. And that was attractive. And it was interesting because they had done them. And it was easy because all I had to do was put them on a bulletin board. If any of you teachers don't have any problems with knowing what to do with a bulletin board, well, there's your first bulletin board right there. Now, of course, it's not there when they walk in the first day of school, but by the end of beginning of the fourth day of school, it is very attractive. There's orange, there's green, there's blue, different colors. And I had other teachers look at that and say, wow, that's a neat idea. Unfortunately, I couldn't claim it as my own, but I had learned it from somebody else, which is most of what we teach from anyone. Things we teach, we learn from other people. Well, that's a couple things for first day activities. Devotions. Sing. And what I did is I would take choruses, song, good singing songs. Most of my experiences were 7th and 8th grade, junior high. And I would put these little overhead transparencies, and I'd get my overhead projector out, and I'd put them down. Now, this is a public school, and you're not really supposed to do, you know, religious training, but we were given a lot of leeway. We had a lot of leeway in that. So anyway, I would put overhead transparencies on, and we would sing. You know what? I almost couldn't get them stopped. You know, we'd sing for 10 minutes, and they'd want to keep right on going. Now, of course, they might have all had ulterior motives, too. You know, I didn't fall off the apple cart just yesterday, either. And with all the shenanigans that I pulled in school myself, there were very few new ones that were pulled off on me. But they did enjoy singing, and so I would put overhead transparencies on one after another, and I enlarged the print, of course, so that they were easily seen. And they just, you know, there's something about that having on the overhead that made a big difference. I'd lay one, you know, one after another. And before you knew it, 10, 12 minutes had passed by. And they thoroughly enjoyed it. By the way, these were Amish students. And so they just, I still have, you know, 25 years later, I have them coming to me and tell me how, what kind of a highlight that was for them. Catchy choruses that they just thoroughly enjoyed it. And what 7th and 8th grader doesn't enjoy that? I mean, I'm sure they could still do it today. That's an idea. Memorizing scripture. Of course, this is a public school. And so, you know, how much religious training are you allowed to do? Well, we had a fair amount of freedom. So what I did is 1 year I took the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And it worked out to, if we memorized 3 verses a week, we got through the whole Sermon on the Mount. It was not mandatory. They didn't have to do it. And I told them that if they accomplished it, it'd be worth, the prize would be worth their while. But I didn't tell them what the prize was. By the way, I taught 50 miles from where I live. These are Amish children, so they weren't going to be driving past the teacher's house every other night or whatever. But they didn't know where I lived. So I told them that the prize would be worthwhile. And I said they didn't have to do it, but I said I would keep record of, I said you could make up to 4 mistakes. They could make up to including 3 mistakes. And what I did is we would take 3 verses a week. On Friday morning, I would hand out a slip of paper with the key words, or some of the words of the verse, with a lot of blanks. So they basically had to memorize the verses. And then they would turn them in. And remember, they were allowed to make up to 3 mistakes, including 3 mistakes. And I would record that in my grade book. There were some that opted not to do it at all. But most of them were curious enough to figure that whatever this guy has up his sleeve, it might be worth, you know, doing. At the end of the year, you know, the Sermon on the Mount, that's quite an accomplishment to have the Matthew 5, 6, and 7 under your belt. I had students that could quote it perfectly. Absolutely, these are Amish students, perfectly. And the next year then, the alternate year, then I took a half a dozen psalms, the better, well, more well-known psalm, did it with psalms. Well, the first year, after we did the first year, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, I told them that, by the way, those that made more than 3 mistakes weren't totally disqualified. They could retake the fill-in-the-blank quiz later on if they wanted to. So it was, I encouraged them to keep trying if they failed. So out of the Well, the first year I did this, out of about 45 students in 7th, 8th grade, out of 45 students, I probably had 35, three-fourths of them qualified. And so I told them, at the end of the year, I told them, I said, I'm going to pick them up and bring them out to our house. Well, that in itself was, wow, you know, where does this guy live? Does he live in a shanty, or what's his place look like? Is it a boy's yard? Does he have goats out chewing in the grass? Well, anyway, so a certain day, evening in August, I said I would come and get it. It should be ready by, I don't know, 4 o'clock there. So I think the first year we had like 35 qualified. And you should have seen the disappointment in the ones that didn't try to make it or didn't do the effort. They were really let down. Because after all, where does this guy live anyway? Does he live in a hovel, or what's his place look like? So anyway, I picked them up. Of course, we had to use 2 or 3 vans to do this. Brought them out to the house, and we started out by playing some outdoor games in the yard. And then we had a picnic lunch, supper. Then maybe we played some more games. And then I took them home. Now, this was an hour's drive from where I lived. And to just see where the teacher lived, I mean, you know, well, he doesn't live in such a rundown place now, after all. I mean, ours is just an ordinary house. But just to see for the first time where this teacher that they've been listening to for all year, where he lived, and that he does have sort of a normal life. And so anyway, I would take them home. They were reluctant to leave. I mean, I had an hour's drive, so we left at 9 o'clock. You know, barely hit the moment before midnight. You know, I had this all paper appearance. I mean, I tell you what, the next year, they were ready to go. And so we did the Sermon of the Mount 1 year. Then the alternate year, we did a half a dozen songs, and then Sermon of the Mount. So they all knew what was coming. And we had grand participation, and I had students that could quote it without error, and they enjoyed it. And it was no big thing. It was 3 verses at least, fill in the blank, you know. Yeah, you had to do a little work. You weren't required to do it, but if you did it, if you accomplished it, the reward was somewhat, I think, somewhat worthwhile. You got to see where the chief teacher lived. He doesn't live in a hovel after all, you know, or whatever. So that's something you might want to keep in mind. That you might need to tailor that to your own teaching needs. I had the advantage of living 50 miles from where I taught. I go 50 miles every morning and evening. And so I had plenty of time to concoct ideas while I was driving. In the morning, I would be thinking of things, you know, how I could do this. In the afternoon, I let my brain sort of unwind and relax. Number 4, story time. Do it. Even 7th and 8th graders. Now, I'm not sure about high school students, but 7th and 8th graders love to be read to. They really do. And so I would usually take the first period right after lunch, and I would set aside maybe 15 to 20 minutes and read some really good books to them. And I didn't prepare a list of those books, but you have book lists, I'm sure. And 7th and 8th graders especially, they really enjoy that. And there were times when we just about couldn't stop reading. You know, it was so interesting. And we read the Treasures of the Snow, and, books like that. And it was just sometimes. And I think over the years, those classes that have had reunions, and some of those have come out as being highlights for them. They mentioned those as being highlights. So do it. Read good, wholesome books. 7th and 8th graders aren't too old, and I would even stretch it farther into older grades. If you get a really good classic, 9th and 10th graders, I don't know why they would enjoy being read to. It's a really outstanding classic. Discipline. Respect students and they will respect you. I found that to be true. And a lot can be said there. I will leave it at that. By the way, at the end here, I would like to set some time aside for, you know, some discussion. So if something triggers your mind, make a notation or something, you know, we'll talk about it. Be firm but kind. There's nothing that takes place of firmness. You can't be their buddy. You just can't be their buddy. Even if you're only, I'm not going to ask for you to raise your hand, how old you are. Even if you're a young school teacher, 19 years old, 20, you can't be their buddy. You're not very much older than some of your oldest students, but there's no way that you can bring yourself down to their level. Now, it doesn't mean that you're better than they are, but you are the teacher, you are in charge of the classroom, and so you need to keep it at that level. You really do. You lose respect if you try to become buddy-buddy with your students, and especially if you are not much older than they are. But be firm, but kind. Rules. They're important. How many? I've tried various things. I've had as many as 10 or a dozen, and sometimes it becomes overwhelming. All these rules, and I've found that fewer rules are better. You know, have a few basic rules that you really feel are important for yourself, and then stick to them like molasses. Don't deviate. Once you give in, you don't have to be a Hitler necessarily, but once you start giving in, and then they'll catch the idea soon that, well, this doesn't mean anything. But within reason, you can be somewhat flexible. There's no point in going into a lot of detail, but some flexibility, of course, is in order, but fewer rules are better, I think. Several years, I tried this. It kind of worked. I think it kind of works depending on what grade of the people in your classroom. I know several years, I only had three rules, and the three were respect yourself, respect others, and respect property. That pretty well covers everything. So if some misbehavior came up, it pretty well fell under one of these three categories. And so you don't have to have this long list on the wall of do-nots or whatever. So sometimes that works. It works pretty well. And of course, this may work better with older students than with maybe first or second graders. By the way, at the end here, I had no idea how much to prepare for, because sometimes you forget how. But if you have questions at the very end, I would be very happy to entertain whatever questions that you may have. Letter D, don't make rules you don't intend to enforce. You'll make a joke out of yourself if you do that. If it's something you want done in your classroom, then put it down and hold them to that. Of course, within reason, you can be flexible, but flexibility, you got to be careful if you start playing the favorites thing, letting this one go and not this one over here. Boy, they'll pick that up just like that, and especially junior high school students will pick that up. Any kind of inconsistency on your part, they will pick up real, real fast. So you have to really be careful that you're consistent with your discipline. And if someone has an infraction of the rules, you got to be very, very careful. So don't make rules unless you intend to enforce them. And then if you make the rule and if they're broken, then follow through with some kind of appropriate punishment. I should have said also, in my 23 years of of teaching at a public language school in Homestown. It's a public school, by the way. And so we're all Amish. In the first 16 years, I had a self-contained classroom. I had the 7th and 8th graders all day. And I taught all subjects. The last 7 or 8 years, I taught with a team. We had a large enough student body. We had 2 7th grades and 2 8th grades. And so I did the social studies and several other things like spelling. So we all did our own spelling and maybe composition, things like that. But where was I going with that? Each student could figure out we all had our own classroom rules. The teacher B over here would have a different set of rules for his class than what I did and the other two teachers. So they get to know what is expected from each classroom teacher. So if you're going to make a rule, stick by it, enforce it, expect it of them. If you don't want to do that, then don't even bother making the rule. They'll soon find out which rules are important, which rules aren't, and which ones they can get by with, and whatever. All right. Be a friend and not a buddy. I learned very quickly that, especially as a young teacher, I think young teachers probably just be more, for young teachers, you're closer to their age. And so it may be more tempting for a young teacher to try to be on the same level. And it does not work. Even you young teachers, don't try to bring yourself down to their level. It does not work. You don't have to be nasty or you don't have to be mean or sour. I've heard crack a joke now and then. And they always enjoy that. I've always had students asking for a new joke. It can be overdone. It can be, you have to use some discretion there. Be a friend, but not a buddy. You're not their buddy. And if you bring yourself down to their level, you're just asking for trouble. You really are. You be their friend. Elsie irritated me, but should I have disciplined her? This is what happened. One day I was, we ate in this large Amish school. It was a fairly large, we had a student body of about 250. And so we had a full-fledged gymnasium and cafeteria. And we all ate in shifts in different grades and so on. So some classes ate, and then after they were done eating, they got to play in the gym. And then while others were playing in the gym, they might have had to sit on the bleachers to wait for their turn. So one day, I got my food in the cafeteria, and I was on my way back to my classroom, right? And there I could eat in peace. And anyway, what happened, as I was going down the side of the gym, this basketball comes and bumps along and hit me and hit my tray, and of course, part of my food was spilled and what have you. And I looked over at the bleachers, and Elsie was just laughing. I mean, she just laughed like everything. And you're kidding. Well, probably shouldn't. It shouldn't. Anyway, I went back to the cafeteria, got a new tray, went back to my classroom, and ate. Well, I dealt with Elsie. Back in those days, we would give out detentions. We used detentions almost exclusively for misbehavior, infraction of the rules. We used the detentions, what they were, I'm taking this out, a detour here now, but the detention was, we had about a 48-minute lunch period. And the first part of it was about 15 minutes long, where they had 15 to 20 minutes where they could eat. And then the rest of the 15 to 20 minutes was a recess. They could go outside and play, or some played in the gym. So anyway, The way that we did our detentions was, they got to go to the cafeteria line, the head of the cafeteria line, got their lunches, ate, they had 15 minutes to eat, and then they had a report to one of the classrooms. And we had four classrooms, there was 2 7th grade and 2 8th grade teachers, there were four of us. And each one of us had a detention room at noon. So they were to report to the detention room then, and they had to work on homework or be at work or something like that. They had to stay quiet. And so it was a fairly effective mode of discipline, especially for 7th and 8th grade students, because it just kills them to not be able to be outside playing ball or playing with the rest of the class. And it just kills them to do that, to miss that. And so the detentions were fairly effective. So anyway, I nailed Elsie, and I gave her detention. And I noticed a real difference in her attitude from there on down. It sort of went south from there on down. And I began to think the rest of this is like later in the year, I think this happened. And I really had to think, I asked myself, was it really worth? I'm not, stopping and thinking why she left. It might have looked kind of funny that, a teacher sharing his tray of food and this ball comes and knocks it around and he spills about, half of it. I might laugh too if I'd see somebody and see that happen to somebody. So I think if I would have had to do over again, I think I might do that a little bit different. So those things happen. So teacher, take lots of time to think things through. Try not to discipline at the drop of a hat. Let yourself cool down a little bit. Sure, it irritated me. My food was spilled, and I was not happy. And then to look over there on the bleachers and see her laughing, that surely didn't add to it. But, after it was all over with, and weeks later, I thought, that might have looked kind of funny. And she may not have intended at all what I went into. She may not have intended at all. So I think I would have handled that slightly differently if I had the chance to do over again. You might be able to relate that to a situation of your own. Handle it slowly and don't jump on something. If there's an infraction if something comes up, don't jump on it like a frog or a fly. Cool it, take your time. You might even talk to the student and say, I saw that. I wasn't appreciative of what I saw. I'm going to think about what we can do about that. And you might even get a really heartfelt, honest apology from that student. Especially 7th, 8th graders aren't too quick to apologize anyway. But you might get a real heartfelt apology out of that student. And you may not even have to come through with any major discipline. And there again, you'll have to use your judgment. Maybe discipline will have to be in order. What time does this end? Is it 11:15? Is it 5 o'clock? I thought it was 11:15. Okay, I think it's 11:15. All right. Don't make rules you don't tend to enforce. I learned that early in my teaching experience. If you don't intend to follow through with the rule, then just please don't make it. Fewer rules I have up over at C, I found that fewer rules are better. It is long, this 12 to 15 rules. It's overbearing. Which rule did I transgress? Now, I think fewer is just plain better. Anyway, be careful about that. Letter G. Was Leroy misbehaving? Maybe he wasn't. He was an eighth grader. And I usually kept my desk in front of the room. Sometimes I, during the year, I would move it to the back room just for variety's sake. You know, they like variety just as well as you do. And one day I looked up, and Leroy was just laughing. I mean, he was just red-faced, and he was just shaking with laughter. And I thought to myself, what in the earth is going on back there now? I think there might have been one or two others that were laughing, too. I'm kind of embarrassed to tell this story. So, you know, typical teacher, I got a little irritated because nothing died for me for all I know. Anyway, so I marched back and I tapped him on the shoulder. So we went out back to the hallway. And I tried to get out of him what's so funny. And he was telling me. And that irritated me all the more. That this is kind of embarrassing. Kind of irritated me all the more. I mean, the audacity of laughing like that in my classroom, and then on top of it, not being able to tell me, you know, what is so funny. Well, what happened was somebody had gas in the general area, and you probably know the rest of the story. This is funny to a few people. And he was too embarrassed to tell me what happened. Well, what eighth grader wouldn't be? And as soon as I found out what it was that had occurred and what caused the laughter, I said, "That's all right. Never mind." I said, I just wondered what was. I tried to put him at ease as quickly as I could. But you know, odd things like that can happen in the classroom. You never prepare for it. You never really realize it. So was he misbehaving? No, he wasn't. He was just reacting in a gentle way to something rather odd. One of the things that I struggled with, number six, I struggled with this. I really wanted to be liked. What teacher does it? How many of you deal with that? If you want to be liked. And you want to be liked a little bit better than the other teachers, right? I mean, they all like Miss So-and-so, but they like Mr. So-and-so just a little bit better because he does, you know, whatever, he fills the blanks. Well, you know, I guess all of my teaching years I struggled with that whole thing of rewarding and bribing. And it's important to draw the line somewhere. You need to know where that line is. You want to reward, but at the same time, you don't want to bribe either. And I discovered that even with seventh and eighth graders, as old as they are, they like rewards. I mean, you'd think a little candy bar about this long would be insignificant to a seventh and eighth grader, but the several times that I forgot about it, they would remind me. The worst. What I would do is, for different kinds of awards, there may have been a candy or something. And what I did, and maybe I shouldn't have done this, I don't know how you feel about competitiveness and how much competition should you foster or encourage. But a lot of times, if I had a large 7th, 8th grade, I would form two teams. And we would pit one against the other, depending what it is, and I would reward them with little candies. And they would remind you. 7th, 8th graders will remind you. Well, we didn't get our candy yet. And I think your words are important, but don't carry it too far to where you're just trying to bribe them into whatever. But your words are important. And if they're important to 7th and 8th graders, I know they're important to the primary grades as well. You'd be surprised at what an inexpensive little piece of candy or a small candy bar will do. It does wonders. It really does. And like I say, they'll remind you, they remind me if I forget. In the last 7 years where I was teaching, we had 2 7th grades and 2 8th grades. We had that large of a school. And so I taught mostly Ohio history and world history. And so I would pit 1 7th grade against another 7th grade. And I would take, for example, we took a test. I would take and average the classes did the whole average. And 7A and 7B, and if 7B had a higher test average than 7A, I would reward that class. And if I would forget it, they'd remind me, you didn't get our candies yet. And it was just a small way to kind of encourage, working hard. And they took it pretty seriously. And what also happens is that students who are really kind of struggling, but they know that they'll pull the whole class average down if they don't do well. So it encourages them to. And I've gone to 7th and 8th graders who were not on top of things scholastically, would put extra effort into being prepared for a test simply because they wanted to help pull up the average of the class so that the whole class would be rewarded. Well, you can work that however you want to, but I think it's a neat little way to reward doing well, meeting the goals, whatever the goals would have been. Number 7, projects are viable learning tools. I use scrapbooks, not a lot, but for a number of years, I taught Ohio history. And so I would tell them at the beginning of the year that at the end of the year, they will be turning in a scrapbook. And then I would give them like the table of contents. These are things that you'll include in your scrapbook. And so throughout the semester, if we had a semester, only a semester, sometimes we had a semester, sometimes we had a whole year, throughout the semester, they would be looking for pictures of the magazine or newspaper, whatever, or articles that pertain to that item on their table of contents, and they'd save them. And then toward the end of the year, we'd stop, and then they would start putting together their scrapbook. And they covered everything in Ohio history. You know, you could have early Ohio, Ohio roads, Ohio's leaders, and farming in Ohio, factories, you know, there was all kinds of things. And I have students come to me to this day, students that I had in the around 1970, that's before a lot of you were born. I have students come to me 40 years later and say, I still have my scrapbook. I remember we did that scrapbook. It's probably one of the only things that they remember is that scrapbook they did. And so that's something you can keep in mind. Maybe you can relate it to your own teaching, whatever you're teaching subject. If you're teaching your state's history, that's a good way to do it. Also, when I was teaching Ohio history, toward the end of the year, I had a paint contest. Let me back up. On March 1st, Ohio has Statehood Day. That's the day that Ohio became a state, March 1st, 1803. And so, about a month before then, I would say, all right, class, a month from now, it was Ohio's birthday, so to speak, and so we're going to have a birthday party for Ohio. And so if you want to, you could prepare a cake that has something to do with Ohio, either in the shape of the cake or what you put on top of the cake, and we'll bring the school on Sabbath day, and then we'll judge them. We'll have them judge, and we'll have prizes for, you know, from one down to about six or eight, and then we'll have honorable mention for the rest of it. Then we'll finish the party off with cake and ice cream and whatever. Oh, they had to look forward to that. Well, anyway, and it was not mandatory. It was not, they did not have to bring a cake. But I said that they would get, I don't know, 50 bonus points on their grade if they did. Because, you know, it's a lot of work, especially for mom. Maybe they get the ideas. Well, you should have seen, by the way, I borrowed this idea from my cooperating teacher when I was doing my student teaching. I sold the idea to him. You know, there's all kinds of ideas that you pick up from other people, and you're probably picking them up this week. So I had cakes that were shaped in a, you know, Ohio has a flag with a little thing in it. I had cakes that were looked from the top down like an Ohio flag. And I had round cakes that had the state seal of Ohio is kind of unique. Too bad if you're not from Ohio, but the state seal, and they would make the state seal on top of this cake. It was really interesting. What else? Oh, the state has various symbols. The symbol of Ohio, one of the symbols of Ohio is the ladybug. I had cakes come in the shape of a ladybug. You know, the orange coating with black dots all over it, little things sticking out. I mean, I had some of the most creative ideas come out of those cakes. And I used to have about 40 students. I used to have at least 30 cakes. And so they bring these cakes on the bus in boxes, and then we lay these out on the table. And Carrie, are these 7th, 8th graders? And of course, I say to the judge, I let other teachers do the judging. And we've had our 1st through 6th place. I think maybe I would do that differently. There were some that were so close that maybe I should have had 2 firsts, 2 seconds. Maybe, you know, squeeze them together a bit more. Some cakes are just sort of ordinary. They weren't really all that spectacular. But they got the points anyway. You know, they got just as many points as the ones that got the prize. And I thought that was kind of a neat idea. And you wouldn't believe the cakes that we got. The shapes and what was on top. I mean, you turn a 7th, 8th grader loose with creativity, and they'll come up with things that you never thought of. And we had a lot of fun with that. And then, of course, at the end, we had cake and ice cream and whatever junk goes with it. And and then we played games. I would get games ready that had to do with Ohio history. And that was some really neat games that we had. And they just, we had a, it was a fun time that was also educational and a learning tool. So you could maybe adapt that to something that you're doing. One of the things that I did, number 8, is create teams. Now I know this whole thing of competition is kind of a sensitive subject. You hear sometimes that you should downplay competition, not even have it at all. The other extreme, of course, is be so competitive and have everything so competitive that it unnerves a student and puts them on edge and things like that. I think, from my 31 years experience, there's a happy medium. I think some good, wholesome competition is good. And not to the point where it puts somebody down and elevates somebody else, but I think just youngsters, students enjoy competition. And it kind of gives them some incentive to work toward. So I know one year I had a large class of 7th and 8th graders in a self-contained classroom. I had them all day for all 7s. And they were, I noticed the very beginning that they were especially bright. This is going to be a really good class. A lot of talent in here. Really talented 17th graders. Not your normal cover of them, just like I was when I was in 17th grade. But anyway, I did, after I kind of got to know who they were, and a lot of them came to attend the same church I did, I put them into two groups. I think I called the one torchbearers, and the other group were the lamplighters or something like that, some fancy name, I don't know what. I put them in two groups. And I said, throughout the year, we're going to compete with each other. And then at the end of the year, the losing team is going to treat the winning team to some kind of a party. We keep track of points. And so I think that's what we did. And you would, but we had the most fun. We had the most fun. They, of course, we went out the ball field. The torchbearers played the lamplighters. And we did, if we had a contest in the classroom, maybe getting ready for a test. You know, one of the best ways to get ready for a test is to do a contest. They like that. And so that's one of the best ways of getting, anyway, we'd have one team compete with the other team. Now, I tried not to overplay it. I tried to use some common sense, but just some ordinary competition, I think. Pin competition is good, and they would just eat that up. They would just gobble that up. Anyway, create, and then we did it with various activities. So you'd be surprised. Sometimes we did the test scores. So the torchbearers had the highest average over that test than the lamplighters did. And so they got X number of points, and this team got X number of points. And, so it was good, clean competition, and it gave the underachievers a chance. Oh, let me back up. When we did it with a test score, the underachievers sometimes, you know, carried a lighter load, but maybe out of the ball diamond, they carried a heavier share. But a lot of times, the underachievers in the classroom will excel at something else. And so I try to have them compete on various levels, not just academically, but other things as well. And it really created a good mood, and it wasn't undue competition, competitiveness. It wasn't at all. I tried to keep that down. Tests. You know, who likes tests? You find students that enjoy tests. How many of you create your own tests? How many of you make your own tests? Several. Many of you are using tests. Another question I was going to ask, how many of you teach in a conventional classroom where you teach the, okay? And how many of you teach in an individualized? Okay, it's not quite half and half. Now, of course, when you do the individualized, you're probably using the company tests, right? How many of you that are using in a conventional classroom use tests that are already made up by somebody? How many of you find yourself in that category? How many of you make up your own tests? Okay, not very many. A few people do. I found this to work in my 7th and 8th graders, especially like Ohio history. I'll just use that for example. When I made my Ohio history tests, I would use a variety of test questions. I would use some multiple choice. But by the way, I have a whole story on true false that I'll have time on really. But I would use a lot of multiple choice, fill in the blank. What else is here? A few essay, because after all, if you give 4 essay questions to a total of 40 students, you know what you'll be doing the next couple of hours after school. Well, anyway, so I used to work in, especially multiple choice, I would work in 1 or 2 dumb questions that had to do with myself. For an example, a multiple choice question might go like this. Mr. Dingrich, A, played for the Cleveland Indians from 1950 to 1956. B is also a skydiver. C, I mean, the three were not only ridiculous, but they were fun. And then D was a correct one, and I usually try to pick one about myself that they might not have known. And so I might have said, sing with his church choir. Well, you know, they didn't know that. So they, it was pretty obvious that three of them were so far out ridiculous that they couldn't have been right. Anyway, I had students that if, when a test was handed out, that's the first thing they hunted for, is these dumb questions that I put in. And what they did is, it, if they got it right, it gave them just as many points as any other question on the test that they got right. So it was an easy way to collect some extra credit points for themselves without having a lot of work. By the way, I learned that from another teacher too. Incidentally, true false. I wasn't going to talk about true false quizzes. Do any of you make up true false statements? Several of you do. Well, let me give you my little analysis on true false statements. One year I was teaching at our own church school. I was teaching Mennonite history. I remember going through John Forrest's book, Mennonites in Europe, which is a tough one to begin with. For 10th graders, about as interesting as last year's pile of leaves, you know. So we were going through John Forrest's book, and each day I would assign to these 10th graders maybe two chapters. And to make sure they read their assignment, I would begin the next class period with about a 10 statement true or false quiz. And I would stand there and I said, we did this work. I would read the statement twice, and they would mark their papers. And I would belabor the evening before, I would labor over preparing these statements so that they have to really think carefully. And, you know, to make sure these guys were reading their reading assignment from the night before. So, you know, it didn't take long to do 8, maybe 10 statements. Didn't take long. They could mark their paper true or false and event. Maybe we could grade it right away. And, but if I could make sure they were doing their reading. Well, one day, Wayne walked in late. He was working on the yearbook. These are 10th graders, which is excusable. He was working the yearbook. So he walked in at about question number 6. And I said, Wayne, we'll finish. And then when we got back, I'll just read them all real quickly, the first 6 of you missed. And then we'll have, well, we finished the quiz, I don't know, 10 questions or 12, 11. Anyway, and he said, oh, never mind. He said, I marked my paper. Well, out of the 6 or 8 that he didn't even hear, he got about 7 right. Well, you know, there's a 50-50 chance that you can guess without it. And you know what? Right then and there, I quit using true false. I figured if you get that good of an average out of not even hearing the statement, perceiving the statement, that's enough for that. So I stopped until I ran into Ron Border. I don't know if any of you know Ron Border or not, but Ron, when he was in high school, won the Eisenhower Award, the very first Eisenhower Award. He lives in Minerva. Got a master's degree in, I don't know what, smart guy. He told me he had a teacher in California who used true-false quizzes. For any of you that make your own true-false quizzes, this is a good idea. If you have a true-false statement, the idea, if you answered correctly, you get a point, which you should. If you don't know the answer, leave it blank, and you lose a point. If you put an incorrect answer in, you lose 2 points. So you've got a student, and here's a statement. They should know, based on what you've been doing the last week, they should know whether that's a true or false statement. If you know the answer, mark it. If you don't know the answer, leave it blank. You will lose a point, which you should anyway. If you don't know the answer, you should lose a point. But if you try to outsmart the teacher, say, well, I got a 50-50 chance here of getting it right if I just guess at it, By the way, he should know the answer. Because it's a statement, it's something you talk about in class very clearly. But anyway, I had students who would come up with negative points at the end of that. Just an 8-point quiz, you know. They came up with it. That happened once or twice, and then they got the message really quickly. If I don't know the answer, then I better leave it blank. And it was a very, then I started using true-false statements, kind of, again, to some degree. So a little humor goes a long way. And when I did true-false statements, once I used those again, and they lost 2 points if you got it wrong, I would put some foolish statement in about myself that was so off the wall that you knew it was, you know, true or false. And so, and they enjoyed that. The 7th and 8th graders enjoyed it. They hunted for those statements. What did Mr. Gingrich say about himself today? And they liked that. Involve your students, with yourself with your students at recess, whatever age, especially if you teach from primary grades up to 7th and 8th graders. Enjoy when I came off the ball diamond and played ball. Here's old teacher. He's out here with us. They liked that. And sometimes they would send an envoy into the classroom, and I was in my classroom studying for the next, preparing for the next class. We'd like to see you come out and play ball. They may have had ulterior motives too, you know, because we get a 5 or 10 minutes extra here. But that's an old trick that I used to play in our, he used to play in our teacher's again. Just before the bell would ring, Mr., I almost said his name, how about a game of ping pong? Oh, yeah, he'd say. And by the way, he was absent-minded. He was so absent-minded. And we took advantage of it. And we'd get him involved in some ping pong. We'd get another 15 minutes after he said it. So everybody's got to be careful of that. But they enjoy that. I think, aside from the ulterior motives, they do enjoy. Now, you can't always. Sometimes you have things that you need to do and get out of the way before the next class. But as much as possible, I think it's good to involve yourself with your student at recess. Number 11, take a hike. Sometimes, and I learned this from another two teacher, sometimes in the spring, you know how things get in the spring, about April, things sort of get draggy. Can you imagine what happens? School dismisses at 3:15, and the last period of class comes up, and you say at 2:30, they're getting their books and papers out. You get trained to do that by you. You get their things out without you telling them. You get their books and papers out, and they're all ready to go. And you say, class, we're going to take a walk this last period, and you'd be surprised at you know, the reaction you get. And so the one school where I worked at or taught at, we had a rural road, so we would get out of the classroom, walk down this. I had a few rules, of course. We would walk down this rural road, maybe a half a mile or a mile, and just turn around and come back. They just loved that. So, especially on a Friday afternoon, totally unexpected. Now, I'm going to leave you with a statement that my wife would make me every year, many, many times. She's a wise woman. She said, Roy, I want you to remember this statement here. If you forget the other things that I've been talking about today, apply this to yourself. She said many times over, said, Roy, your students will forget about what you taught them in years to come, but will not forget you as a person. Now, you can word that however you want to, but she said it. And you know what? I believe that your students will forget. I used to pore over my class preparations, and word those true-false statements I made prepared for those 10th graders, I would make them so you had to listen really careful, so you know one word might change the idea. But you're so careful as from your teaching profession to do just the great job that you're doing. But you know what? 15 years down the road, they'll forget a lot of things that you taught them. Remember you as a person. how you reacted and how you responded to certain situations. That's what's going to last with them. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm sorry, there is no time for discussion, but so be it. Thank you very much. I hope some of this will be of help to you in your classroom. And I hope you have a good year this coming year. God bless you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.